This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batsu. It's great fun to spend time with two classicists who have translated the Aeneid, because I'm aware of the fact that we're telling a whopper of a tale in pieces. You know, it's like this is the thriller highlights that we put up on the screen for you to watch the whole movie. So we come now to the history of this incredible whopper. Scott, it came to me as I was reading over, not necessarily looking for it, that there kept coming back and back justification for the civil war conduct of the Romans, and that they were destined. That word is overused here. It was written in stone, and the gods agreed that Rome would be founded by these violent events, and that everything in the future would be predicted at the time of the founding of the city, including the battle of the success that Octavian had becoming the emperor. So at some point it occurred to me, I said, this is Roman exceptionalism. That's how this document could be used. Was it used that way, Scott?
I think it's, as you say, it certainly could be, and I do believe it was, and I believe it's been, I mean, it's been read like that till today, right, as a document justifying Rome. And the idea that Rome is the fated power of the world, the fated empire of the world, that is written into the poem, I think, without question, right? Certainly certain passages in the poem, one in book one, one in book six, one in book eight, they explicitly make the case. There are ways of kind of complicating that reading, but I do think it's there. And I do think, you know, that is a part of what Virgil is up to. But it doesn't tell the whole story, because if this were just a kind of propaganda piece for Rome, it would have historical interest, sure. Right. But I don't think it would have deep kind of literary interest, and the kind of literary interest that's kept it alive for 2000 years. I think what Virgil's able to do is, to some degree, champion Rome and champion Rome as the fated exceptional empire of history. But he also brings out the human side of that. It's a grand historical story told at the human scale, fundamentally. And important to that is the tremendous sympathy that he shows to all his characters, especially Dido. Of course, Dido opposes the Trojans ultimately and the Trojan mission, right? And yet she, as you said, steals the show in book four and is given the best lines. Turnus, at the very end of the poem, who has to be vanquished, he's the great adversary of Aeneas. Sympathies at the very end of the poem lie more with him than with Aeneas. We know more how he is feeling at the end of the poem than we do Aeneas. All we see from Aeneas is rage, right? Wrathful rage. So the complicated kind of emotional life of this poem is really notable, I think, that allows it to transcend any kind of propaganda, I would say.
Susanna, I'm clearly overreading, but you two have encouraged me, so that's my excuse. Kingship does not look terrific here. Kingship is an addendum to Aeneas' destiny. Kingship makes some bad choices. Kingship betrays. Is that Virgil expressing some doubts about where he is in Rome?
I think it's very tempting to read it that way, right? This is not a poem that gives us a really kind of fully glorified vision or an Aeneas who really aspires ultimately to be kind of a king. And we also see, you know, in addition to Aeneas himself, we see figures like the king Latinus, the elderly king of the Latins, the native inhabitants of Italy, with whom Aeneas winds up being at war. He's really, in many ways, kind of a pretty weak leader. So I think this is one of the aspects of the poem where we can see maybe there's a something of a suspicion of kind of overly coercive individual political actors, and an idea that this kind of power does come with hazards. I think this is one of the ways in which Virgil can be read as, you know, even as he emphasizes, as Scott said, the kind of fated rightness of the Roman future, he also goes about that in a way that doesn't maybe unequivocally endorse the new model of governance that Augustus has created and the new system of power that's being consolidated, even as he writes the poem in the 20s BCE.
And Scott, can we guess that this is the origin of Augustus using that workaround called princeps? He wasn't ready to wear the crown?
Well, yeah. So what Augustus's achievement in the 20s, essentially establishing one man rule, but preserving enough of the kind of framework of the Republic so as to avoid the fate of his adoptive father, Julius Caesar. It's a pretty remarkable achievement. He's able to kind of square the circle.
Right.
And Princeps is a part of that. Princeps has a long Republican history. That title has a long Republican history. And he adopts that title along with Augustus, along with some others, that allows him to maintain a kind of veneer, at least, of Republicanism.
30 seconds, Professor. Please continue.
Sorry, a veneer of Republicanism while he assumes absolute power.
The achievement, I congratulate both of you, is that I know everybody who's listened to us going, well, what happens? Well, it's time to read the book, The Aeneid, The Aeneid, by Virgil. Introduction by Emily Wilson, translated into iambic pentameter, ta-dum, 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 by Professor Scott McGill and Professor Susanna Wright of Rice University.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.